Okay, the final speaker in this workshop is Dr. John Mouton from the Netherlands, and he's going to be presenting on rules-based processing and auto-validation in medical microbiology. Mouton?
Thank you. Just what you've heard from the previous speakers, what middleware can do in your laboratory for a number of indications, and what I'll be talking about is the use of middleware in the medical micro lab. To give you a little bit of background about myself, with three colleagues, we run a large regional clinical laboratory with around 60 FTE that do all the microbiology processing for the whole region. So we have an area of around 600,000 patients, three hospitals, a number of primary care physicians between 300 and 400 that we all have to serve, and they all have their special requests on how they want their reports. So the first question that we have to ask ourselves, at least in medical microbiology, is the why. Why do we need more automation and more validated processing? And this is not, at least for us, as we go to the clinical wards every day. I spend a lot of time on the ICU unit to discuss the results we have in the lab and what to do, which antibiotics to give to our patients. The main problem is that we have an enormous time lag between the sampling and the test results. And as we've seen from the first speaker, this may end up in quite some time in comparison to total turnaround time. So the incentive to automate the process a little bit more is to shorten the time span between sampling and test result. And to give an idea how important this is, I spend a lot of time giving lectures on how to use antimicrobial agents in clinical practice. This is a slide that I took from one of these lectures, is that mortality and delay in effective antimicrobial therapy has a real impact on patient health. The what you see here is the delay in effective therapy with a risk odds ratio of more than 5 related to a delay in effective therapy, primarily related to the fact that that the sensitivity results of the lab were not in time, or where there was too much resistance that was not reported early enough. The second issue is, of course, from a management point of view. Decision-making in patient care, as we've seen from the previous speakers, for us, very important epidemiology and resistance alerts, which antibiograms are different from other antibiograms, abnormal lab results, and importantly also the increasing complexity in the micro lab, where we have more diseases, more treatment options, and especially immunosuppressed patients, all kinds of difficult health issues. Our major problem in our lab actually is that we have increasing difficulties with finding educated lab technicians that have the skill and know enough for the whole process. And in the old days, where we had the authorization process and everything with a head lab technician that did know everything, is simply not there anymore. We don't have the head lab technician that knows everything because there's just too much information there. So our focus is more, has become more and more on quality control and process management, the audit trails, and of course using management information to do that. You've seen timing per sample from the previous speakers as an example. So if you look at the processing of microbiology specimens, how does this work? And I'm starting at the simple diagram here. We have the sampling, the arrival at the lab, you're familiar with that. Then there's the administrative process with numbering, test orders. Then there is the process within the lab itself. And then there's the report. Now basically we have three important parts here. The first is, if you look at it from a rule-based or process point of view, those are the rules here in the during test ordering, the rules based in auto-validation, and the rules and validation during the whole process. Now, we were very familiar in the past with rule-based ordering in our serology department, where, for instance, we have a hepatitis B request. Note that this is not a request for a test, but a request for a disease. The clinician, the request of the physician is, does this patient have hepatitis B, or is there something with hepatitis B? And we translate that in the lab, if necessary, to test orders, which may be different depending on the clinical information. But we can process this reasonably easy in an automatic system. And we have then all kinds of rules that add test rules or validation rules within this specific process. Where we use rule-based processing quite a lot is in our reporting. And that's the second step that I've shown you on one of the former slides. For instance, in parasitology, we have tens of rules where we advise the clinician on what to do based on the test result that we have. So if we find, for instance, based on the clinical information that that is there, for instance, has the patient been to the tropics or has not been to the tropics, and what we find in the specimen, we add information on how to treat the patients. And the doctors like it because they don't have to look for it in their books. They just write their recipe and they go on with their business. So this is where we use this quite a lot. But to generalize, all these rules that we had and validation processes were primarily used at the beginning and at the end of the whole process in the lab. And then we, of course, have the machines that do all the things that they do, as we have seen, for instance, for CDCs. But it was never used during the process. And one of the primary reasons is that microbiology is something very different from a process point of view as compared to the chemistry lab. And to put these into contrast, the request to the chemistry lab or the hematology lab is, please let me know the concentration of a certain electrolyte, for instance, sodium, so the doctor can decide what to do next. So the doctor gives an order, something is measured, it's either auto or not auto-validated, and there is an end result, and that is put into context. We now have the middleware, but we didn't have that in the past. Well, if you look at the micro process in the micro lab, the question actually is not measure something, but they give you a specimen, sputum or feces or whatever. The question is find out what bug there is in there in the context of the disease of the patient. If so, give it a name. And oh yes, I also want to know how to treat the patient, so give me a susceptibility result for a number of antimicrobial agents. So actually what you have here is not one simple test, but you have around between 20 and 200 tests that the lab technician has to run before giving a final end result. And during this whole process, there is a lot of decision making by the lab technician, and to convert this into one automated process using software is very difficult, and it has been it has taken, I think, decades before programs came on the market that could actually do this. So our goal a number of years ago was to have this whole lab with all these papers, as some of you who have been in micro labs are probably familiar with, to get rid of this and to have a complete paperless laboratory. So all the tests and everything that a lab technician does, those 20 between and 200 tests that she runs, to come with a final answer to the clinician, to get rid of that. So to give an idea how this works for those that are not familiar with the micro lab, what typically happens is that on day zero, the sample comes in, the sample is plated on blood agar plates or other plates, it's incubated overnight, then the lab technician looks whether colonies have grown, processes those colonies, look what has to be done with it, makes assumptions on what the colony could be, the identification of the microorganism. On day two, this whole process repeats itself, and she has to do extra tests, et cetera, et cetera, and then comes up with a final result at day three. Now, for your management information, you would like, of course, to know what happens during this whole process to optimize it. So another way to look at it, to automate this, is to look at the weak spots in your whole process that are sometimes very difficult to find if you have a system that works with paper only. To have another look at how complex this process is, a couple of years ago, I was in one of the committees in my country, and we set up a guideline on the basic structure on how to electronic processing of laboratory specimens. And you see loops and loops and loops and loops, and importantly, in the whole process, what happens is there is a result. The result has to be interpreted and results in a next request, which the lab technician processes herself. So there's, again, all these different tests. For every test, there have been decisions on exactly what to do. So in summary, there's a very fundamental difference in processing these specimens, with continuous decision making by the lab technicians on what to do and how they do it, according to all the SOPs that we have, which is partly based on all the clinical information, of course, that the lab technician has as well. So there are, I think, over the last 6 or 7 years, several companies that have looked into this and tried to write software that could help the process within the lab. And I'm going to show you a number of examples from TechniData. This is because we use the system, not just because it's the only system on the market. Actually, in the Netherlands, there is a company that it's based in Belgium, but a lot of laboratories use it, and they use GLIMS, which is a similar type of program. So the basic thing first is to look exactly what system requirements there are in the micro lab. And you can spend 1 or 2 years doing this because there are so many factors that you have to take into account. And then finally, come up with a description of what the system should look like, and all based on the real-time process. Instead of putting in things first and afterwards, it has to be a real-time process that helps the lab technician in making her decision, and is in the end the core of the whole micro lab. So I'll slowly guide you a little bit through some of parts of the program to give you an idea, to also to give you examples of the auto-validation and rules that we have implemented within the system, and that can be used later on for management information tool, epidemiology tools, etc., etc. So first, importantly, we always think, at least in our country, but probably also in the US, that the clinical information that the physician provides to us is very important in how to process the samples. I think we've seen an excellent example from the previous speaker on in hematology, how to use CDC, how to process CDCs, and how to use the auto-validation rules based on the clinical information. So that was one example. Other examples include, was the patient abroad or not? These are sometimes Dutch terms, because it's, of course, we have our own language in our country. We don't speak English, well, most people do, but not during routine practice. So depending on the request, automatically the plates are added following the rules we have in our standard operating procedure. So now there is no thinking of the lab technicians. There is the request, the plates are added, barcoded automatically, and you can then and have a lab technician that is not very well educated just do the plating. Well, in the past, we had a lab technician that had to decide which plates to use. Now the program does it for us. So that helps in finding personnel in our lab. We need far less educated personnel than we used to have in the past. It also automatically tells you how long to incubate the plates, depending on the SOP you have put in the program. So all these rules that decide whether the incubation period should be 24 hours or 48 hours, you have to put in the system, of course. But I think what the advantage is here is that we have our SOPs, which are quite a number. All those SOPs are translated in rules within a system. So there is no discrepancy now between what happens in the lab and what's in our SOP, hopefully. Of course, this part of the process is very, very and highly critical. So deciding what to do with the specimen, because later on, if less well-educated lab technicians are doing a lot of the work and they don't know exactly what to do when something is wrong, this part should be validated very thoroughly. So we have our the lab technicians that are best educated now at the beginning of the process. They decide what to do, and once that's decided, a lot of things can be done by other lab technicians. And this differentiation is not only necessary because we don't have the lab technicians anymore, but it's also very cost-effective because you have, with the same number of people, you have a number of lab technicians that are less well-skilled, and it's therefore cheaper. It's also easier to replace. So what happens the next day? Well, there's a colony grown on one of the plates, and the lab technician thinks it's suspected for instance, a certain type of bacteria. We have implemented the system in such a way that the lab technician has a choice of different microorganisms. And once she chooses these microorganisms, a whole set of rules starts to work again. So for instance, in this specific example, there is a suspicion that it could be a gram-negative rod. And once she also thinks it might be perhaps a Pseudomonas. So she inserts suspected for Pseudomonas, and automatically all the tests that need to be done are inserted in the system. Again, performing these tests can be done by less well-educated personnel. It's just a decision on whether it could be a Pseudomonas or not that has to be done by an educated lab technician. So these are the rules that are inserted in the program that we write, and this is what automatically appears on the screen and then can be handled as such. For instance, we have an oxidase B that needs to be performed and can be done by someone, puts in the result, and then it's automatically translated in the end to whether it's a Pseudomonas or another Pseudomonas. The other important part, and that's actually where I started with, is the susceptibility report, because the susceptibility report actually provides the clinician or the consultant, and that is us, how to optimally treat a patient, which antibiotics to use, which antibiotics not to use. And in this era of increasing resistance, this is very important. As you can see from this result, we don't have that many resistance problems yet in the Netherlands, but it's increasing, and it's becoming more important. So we have a whole set of rules, again, in the whole susceptibility testing process. We have a quantitative MIC test result, and this is actually, I think, one of the questions that was raised before. You can have a validation within the machine to have your MIC, but once You have, and but that's the numerical value that you have. But then you have to interpret that numerical value in a number of ways, and that's where middleware becomes important. So first of all, the interpretation of the value is dependent on the identification of the microorganism. If it is species, it's intrinsically resistant. It should be reported as resistant, even if the value indicates it's susceptible. So this is a rule that is one level higher than the actual measurement in the machine. Then, if it's not intrinsically resistant, you have species-specific breakpoints or values that decide whether the microorganism is susceptible or resistant, and that's then, in the end, the first stage of the report. And in the past, this was all hand work. All these decisions were made by technicians requiring highly specialized lab technicians. Until recently, there were around 50 species that the lab technicians had to be aware of and were very important. But now, and that's mainly because in the past we used phenotypic tests to identify microorganisms. But now that we have microbiology, molecular microbiology, and we do sequencing as on a routine basis in our lab to differentiate the various microorganisms, we get enormous numbers of different names. We have now in our, at least Dutch semantic standard that I chaired, we had now 2,500 entries, different species that are medically important. So these all have, you just can't remember those. You have to put them in a system and then automatically decide whether and what is happening. Because the MIC interpretation depends on the species in identification. And of course, 90% is an E. coli or Klebsiella, but those 10% that are not need a whole database of information. Now let's have a look at a more detailed level at this process. These are the European Committee of Antimicrobial Susceptibility Testing Rules, which is similar to your CLSI. We in Europe have our own committee for that. And one of the things that they did was to set up intrinsic resistance for all gram-negative species. So the first rule in interpretation of the MIC, you have all the species here. These are all the antibiotics, and all the R state is intrinsically resistant. So this is a very, well, this table looks complex. You kind of remember this table. So it's very useful to have this in automatic. This is all gram-negatives. We also have the gram-positives and all these other microorganisms that you've never heard about. Then secondly, if you have those rules based on species, there's a next layer where you have to interpret the interpretation of the former level. For instance, for staphylococci, if it's resistant to one antibiotic, you have to conclude that it's resistant to all the other antibiotics, even if it is susceptible on the first level. So that's the second level. I'll skip this one. And I'll skip this one. So, but then there is a third level where you have to do a reinterpretation, because it might be that there, if it's resistant to this this antibiotic and resistant to this antibiotic, so that's a combination of two antibiotics, then you have to draw another conclusion. So we have three different levels. And this has emerged over the last couple of years, where we now know much more about resistance mechanisms, et cetera, et cetera. But it makes the complexity of decision making in the lab huge. So to show you, just as an example, we have in our microbiology and serology system, we have now more than 1,000 of these decision-making rules, which are only based on this whole process. And in the past, we maybe had 20 or 30 or 40 of these rules that were lab technicians could remember. This is almost impossible for lab technicians to remember if you want to do it state of the art. So we end up with a susceptibility report as an exemplified here. And unfortunately, we have a another level, but that has not so much to do with interpretation as well as what do you want to report to the clinician. In our hospital, we have a system where we don't want some of these results to go to the clinician immediately because we think they shouldn't use certain antibiotics in the hospital. So they only get results for 4 or 5 antimicrobials. If they want more, they can call us. Usually they don't. But sometimes they do, and then it's our job to decide which other antibiotics they might use. So we have a selective reporting, and the selective reporting, of course, depends on which clinician, which hospital. That depends on the rules that you write in your system, but the possibility, of course, should be there. So this whole process in the microlab that's all in the head of the lab technician and the microbiologist now has been, I think over a number of years, has been written down in software that helps us to organize our whole decision-making process and reporting process. Now, once we have these results, we go one level higher and use the information that we have to help us in clinical decision-making and in epidemiology. Importantly, in epidemiology and in history, we always want to know how susceptible was the microorganism in the past? Where has resistance emerged for certain antimicrobials? Is there a different strain? Do we have hospital infections? And typically, you can, that's one of the ways to look at it, is to have the history of a certain patient or of a number of patients and look what happens to the susceptibility results. For instance, here, it was the E. coli was resistant here, susceptible here, and there's a reason for that. So that leads you to looking in what is happening in the patient. For us, one of the most important things in systems like this is the nosocomial alerts. We have a very strong guidelines in the Netherlands, and that is if patients have resistant microorganisms, they are isolated. And we have different levels of isolation. But for instance, patients with an MRSA are completely isolated from any other patients. And the nurses have to wear masks and gloves, et cetera, et cetera. And we have a hospital hygiene department working with 3 or 4 people that guide that whole process. But it's very important, of course, that they are alerted in time. So as soon as we have an MRSA or a vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, it's a microorganism that's resistant to almost any antibiotic that we know, they are alerted. And they can take action to protect, in fact, other patients from that bug. So it's a patient safety issue as well here. This is just an example how there are different thresholds that you can set up in this system for multiple alerts. Of course, you don't want to have this alert after the validation has been set or all the results are present. So what we are looking for is real-time alerts. So as soon as there is suspicion of an MRSA or a resistant enterococcus, we want to be alerted. There are all kinds of ways to do that. We usually do not have this by telephone, but this will be something that will be sent by SMS in the future. In Rotterdam, they are developing a laboratory information system. It's the place I used to work and where the first paperless system was developed 13 years ago, which was not as sophisticated as what you have shown here. But moving into this era, they had to redevelop their whole program. And what they are doing now is it's by the end of the year, there should be some kind of prototype, that there's continuous real-time information, and they have all kinds of rules and system it built into the system to alert, because one of the problems at present is not the information, but the overflow of information. So what we need now is process management of the information that we acquire. And that's where middleware can help us enormously. One of the ways to do that is to get rid of all the negative results as soon as possible and have an overview of all the negative results in the lab. It's what we have been doing over the last couple of years. I don't even see negative results anymore if there's no clinical information. Because if there is clinical information, I want to know, because there might be a reason that it is negative, although it should be positive. But that's the responsibility of the physician. If he does not give us the clinical information, for instance, for blood cultures, all negative blood cultures are completely auto-validated. I don't see them. It's a lab technician that does it. I don't see them anymore. So that was a whole change of thinking a number of years ago. Of course, what always needs to be there is the audit trail, because in this whole auto-validation process, if something goes wrong, you need to know where did it go wrong. And that's where, and not only for that, of course, for the whole management information that you were interested in, the audit trail will give you, is really necessary. This is just an example. Every action that is taken by a lab technician is retrieved with timestamps, and I think you've seen an example by the previous speaker as well, how you can use those time spans to look at turnaround times, to look whether a certain lab technician use more tests than other lab technician. It's very important in the lab. And in the past, we just couldn't do that, because every lab technician was doing a number of samples each day, wrote everything on paper. We just didn't know. Well, we knew some lab technician did 20 and others did 30 in a day, but we never exactly knew where the critical points were for each lab technician. Now it's very easy to look at it and then go to those lab technicians and try to improve their overall workflow. So while you've seen this, this is an example, you've seen this from the previous speaker, so I skip around this very fast. Basically, everything that has been told can be retrieved from a middleware solution such as this, and should be. So how much, yeah. I can, I think I have another couple of minutes to go into one of my other favorite projects, and that is automation. And then integrating automated system in a micro lab and combined with auto-validation processes to have a complete automatic system in the micro lab. Because the problem that's still there with middleware solutions that I showed you is that the lab technician still has to do the work. And it's very difficult to make this an automated process, but there are now a number of solutions, or at least there's one solution that can help in there. So this is a system devised by Kistra Lab Automation in the Netherlands, and it's based on transport of plates automatically throughout the lab. So we have all these transport belts in the lab, and they do the whole control of plate handling. So the plate handling is not done by lab technicians. They can't drop their plates anymore, which sometimes happens. It's a completely automated process. So they come out of the stove, they go back to the stove, fully automated. So this is a picture of the transport to the incubator. And when the lab technician types into the screen which sample she is processing, the plates that she needs are automatically taken out of the stove, transported to her working place. She processed the sample, and it's automatically processed after that again. So that saves a lot of plate handling time. I think we did an evaluation. It's about one quarter to one third of the time that's going to save in our lab is plate handling. Now, this is not the only issue, because what's really interesting here is that they have developed a system to photograph each plate in the incubator. So every plate at a pre-specified time is photographed with a high-resolution photograph. So if you have an incubation for, say you want to incubate a plate for 16 hours, and usually that's at the end of the night, so there's no one in the lab, but the standardized procedure from the CSI tells you it should be incubated for 16 hours. What happens is the plate is run to the photographic machine, there's a photograph is made, it's stored, and next day you have a look at the photograph instead of the plate. Another advantage is that they can't smell at the plates anymore. We don't have any Brucella lab contaminations anymore. And this is typically what you might see. These are a number of example photographs that we have. And it's also easier to discuss with a number of people. You have a very large screen where the difficult examples are shown. Again, a lab technician that's very well educated might process 60 to 100 of these samples instead of maybe 20 or 30 in the morning, because the only thing she has to look at is at the screen and deciding which plates are need processing. All the negative ones, it's, you know, pushing a button, pushing a button, pushing a button. So it goes very fast. Clinical validation of all these processes, of course, using the audit trail, but can be done now on a distance, because I don't have to look at those plates where the lab technician has done her job correctly. I can do it anywhere I want. And I think that's, at least for me, is a very major advantage. So let me give you one example how this may help, but has not helped yet, but in the future, in the process of our samples. One of the problems in Holland is the increase in MRSA prevalence. You don't have that problem because the prevalence is so high that it can't increase anymore. But we still have below 1%. MRSAs are methicillin-resistant staphylococci and are very difficult to treat. So those are patients that carry those bugs. We want to isolate them immediately. Patients that come into our hospital, in any hospital in the Netherlands, and have a possibility of being colonized with an MRSA or infected with an MRSA are isolated immediately until proven negative. So it's very important. Those processes that may take 2 or 3 days in the past. So it's very important to have a fast process and also to have a process that is very efficient. And one example here is in Rotterdam, another hospital, where they used to have an MRSA hospital epidemic a couple of years ago. And they had an increase in samples to 8,000 per month, which for a microbiology is quite a lot, which put an enormous pressure on personnel and, of course, increasing costs. It's still cost effective, because if you keep your MRSA out, the costs of your antibiotics are still very low. So we have this strategy in the Netherlands of search and destroy. I've had this over the years, and it's very successful. But it's important that anyone who is suspected of having an MRSA is isolated. So everyone that comes is screened, and if negative, if positive is on isolation, and if negative can be out of isolation. Now, one of the advantages of chromogenic agars, which have been on the market now for a number of years, that there's a number of companies that provide chromogenic agars that differentiate between MRSA, it's the resistant ones, and the susceptible ones. The green ones are resistant and the white ones are susceptible. And we use these plates now during epidemics, so it's very easy for the lab technicians, oh, this is negative, this is positive. But still, it's a manual process, and the incubation times are quite important. I mean, if the incubation time is too long or too short, you might have come up with different results. So now this is where this autoplate handling comes in. It's not operative yet, but it's, I think, will be in the very near future. So we have this camera from the system. A photograph is made in the middle of the night. We have automatic detection using recognition software being either green colonies or white colonies. If it's a green, it's an alert which is sent immediately to either the lab technician or a clinical microbiologist, and further processing is needed. And if it's white, there is a release of the patient. And this can be done completely and automatically with expert software for recognizing abnormalities. And that saves a lot in technician time, importantly my time, isolation time of patients, and nursing time, because isolating a patient for nurses is terrible. It takes a lot of efforts, and they do it because they know what the gains are, but they don't really like it. So in this, to summarize, in this whole process of auto-validation and rule-based decision-making in the clinical lab, the pre-processing step is very important and should be validated by well-trained lab technicians. And this whole process here, during the administrative process and the initial process, is very important. Those should be highly skilled lab technicians that decide what is going to happen with the sample. The remainder of the process can be guided by programs using process control and quality control instruments, as you've heard from previous speakers. Automatic report negatives can be done automatically depending on the clinical information that is provided, and the alerting system gives us enormous possibilities in the future. And the main question that we have now, and we're spending a lot of energy here, is the validation of the auto-validation. Because if you have an auto-validated, a system that auto-validates, you need to have a real validation of that, all the rules that you set up and put into the system. It's not a headache. You have to think very logically, but it's very, very important. And that's where I am. Thank you. So any questions? I'd be happy to answer. You mean the software or the, well, that's from TechniData, but it works on Oracle that database, and it's like you, we have a... Oh, the question is, on what platform did we use for this system? This is the system that we are implementing now is from TechniData. It's based on an Oracle platform, but you can choose any database for that. The advantage for us is for Oracle is that the whole hospital works with Oracle. That was a decision in the past, and we can use actually retrieve data from that Oracle database out of the middleware system. So that's something that we are starting to develop in once everything runs smooth as it should run. To answer questions that we cannot immediately answer with the system itself.
I think one of the things you really point out nicely is how traditional high volume automated laboratory how important it is to push or to have SOP reminders out there for the test. One of the things I couldn't get a feel of here, do you push those actions to the test or the text like that will pull things to the numbers?
Okay, so the it is a kind of a mix, and depends on where you are in the process. What the system does, it guides more or less the lab technician through the whole process. So the lab technician still has to have knowledge about microbiology in a sense that this might be a gram negative rod, but once she has that feeling, she will be given all tests that are needed to for the further process. Looking more at the beginning of the process, when you have a sputum sample, and it's a very ordinary, let's take a urine sample, and you have a very and it's, there is no, it's just from a patient that has no, there's no clinical information. It's just a basic test. The only thing that is that you have to do is order urine culture. All the, everything that happens afterwards, which plates to use, how long to incubate, et cetera, et cetera, it comes from the system, from the rule base. So that's the SOP translated into the system. You can make it as sophisticated as you want. The problem with rule-based processing is, and that's where the other company I mentioned from MIPS in Belgium, the GLIMS system, they have a very advanced rule-based processing module, but the problem is there that it's so free to use that there's now one lab in Holland that has used the system for 5 or 6 years, and now they have to go to another platform, so they have to migrate their system to another platform. And they have so many rules in there that they don't know exactly what's happening in their system. It's a little bit like the old BASIC for those that have worked with it, that you put in a rule, if, then, and after, without any real giving you any guidance in the structure of how to apply those rules. And that's the danger. If you're very well, if you have very good documentation of what you're doing, that's fine. But usually you do that in the beginning. But, you know, writing rule after rule after rule, sometimes the book, the administration becomes a little bit sloppy in those labs, you know, how things work. So I think you need a certain structure in the whole process, and the either by yourself or a system that guides you to it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Moten. That concludes the workshop this morning.